sort of identity, and that's fixed. And you grow up in one body and you die, and then later on you take another body and you go through many, many bodies like that. So that is the idea of reincarnating, and we get new bodies again and again. So that is quite common in many cultures of the world. It is not admitted in present-day Christianity. But we'll see most other religions do believe in it. All the religions in India, Buddhism, religions like that do. But Christianity and Judaism and probably Islam don't talk about it so much. though there are evidence to show that early Christians did believe in it. Maybe they were influenced by India or whatever, but up until 500 AD, there was philosophy, including the idea of reincarnation, was there. And then at that time, the church decided it was not quite good for the people, so therefore they took it out of the text and suppressed those texts which mentioned it. Though even now we find traces of it in Christ's teachings or whatever. There's a little bit of references to previous lifetimes also. Anyway, it's not there in the present day Christianity. Not admitted. But it is common around the world. So why would it be common? It's of course the idea of religion, the materialistic idea of religion is that people have fears and needs and they feel powerless, so therefore they start worshipping something or other. They make up some deity or god of fire, god of the wind, god of the sun, and they start worshipping, basically. This is how religion comes about. This is the idea of religion, you know. So that's a materialistic conception. In other words, it's functional. And it's not based on reality, actually, of real beings doing anything, but it's only according to our particular material needs. So we have a psychological need, so we create an image of God. And all spiritual life and everything is similar to that, to satisfy some anxieties or whatever. That actually is wrong, because if you look at even primitive religions like shamanism and probably Aboriginal religion here also, it's actually based upon experience, not upon fears. What they believe in is not based upon fear and psychological needs, but it's based upon experiences that people have. Particularly the shamans and the tribe or whatever have certain experiences, and based on that they evolve their philosophy. And similarly, if we look at religion with a sympathetic eye, actually the philosophy comes second and the experience comes first. If someone has an experience, a religious experience, and then they express it to their writings and philosophy and whatever. So it's not exactly expressing a psychological need and then you invent something, but rather these ideas are coming from experiences themselves. That's a more sympathetic view. But then the objection to that would be, well, if people have experience, why don't we experience it now? If they were doing it then, why can't we do it now? We're advanced. Well, one reason, of course, is because we become so externally conscious, it's more difficult for us to access those things. Nevertheless, at the same time, since we're human beings and if we're spirit souls and we do have a spiritual nature, it should somehow manifest. And true enough, it does manifest in spite of modern culture and materialism and etc., all the disturbances. We see that it does actually manifest itself even in the modern world. It may be more prevalent in ancient worlds, probably so, but even in the present world we do get testimony of people who do have experiences which indicate life beyond death and transference from body to body. We have to look for those experiences, of course. We may or may not believe them. It's a matter of our trust again. Do we accept testimony of people? Are they lying or are they telling the truth? So, of course, if we get many people saying the same thing or similar things, of course, and there's some verifiable details, then, of course, we can say that it must probably is true based on those experiences. So one of the advantages, of course, of modern world is we like to do things systematically rather than haphazardly. So scientific method, that is. So it is interesting to note that in science itself, some people have systematically attempted to prove or disprove the soul, or at least reincarnation. And the result is usually being positive. There's one Dr. Ian Stevenson. At a certain point in time, he got interested in reincarnation, and he devoted most of his research through his life, maybe 30 years of research, using his own funding. He didn't get funding from anybody to investigate this. And his main investigation was children who have recollections of a previous lifetime. Yeah? And it happens in all parts of the world. For some reason, India gets a lot of the cases, maybe because they get recorded and people believe in it anyway, so they investigate it more thoroughly and the cases become a little more well known. Nevertheless, there's cases spread all over the world. So his job or his interest was to investigate those cases and see if they were, first of all, true, and try to verify information on them. So he spent most of his time doing that, and personally, as much as possible, he has gone to the different people and interviewed the children, interviewed the parents, interviewed the person they, or the family somewhere else, who they were in their previous lifetime. All these things he's done in great detail and tried to rule out any possibility of fabrications and cheating in the way, whatever. And so he's rejected all cases which may be insubstantial or whatever, and he's taken only those cases which give remarkable evidence. That is, the child can recollect exact details which are later proved to be true, which they can't know in this present body by any means, because they have no association with that particular place or that particular house or the particular people in the house or the history of the people in the house. And if they can give exact details which correspond to that place very far away, then we could say something very strange is happening because they haven't traveled out of their village or town, and they know something about a place which is maybe 100 miles away or something. How can they know? If it's not reincarnation, at least something is there. Some form of information is coming to them from somewhere. At least that much is there. In other words, there's some type of medium of conveying information or experience other than we know in science. Definitely something is mysterious. So he has recorded many cases, very accurate cases, where children have recollected exact details of who their mother and father were, how they died, who their husband or wife was, who their children were, what the house looks like and everything, and it could be verified. And certain of their habits they pick up in this lifetime or from last lifetime, etc. So he's recorded many, many cases like that. And he has one book, about 1,000 pages long, in which he gives the details of many of these cases in a very systematic manner, trying to rule out all possibilities of, fake or whatever. And the cases are very impressive as they stand. Of course, he's dedicated his life to this, to present it to science, to show that it looks like there's some other parts of this material world we don't know about, or part of existence we don't know about, and it looks like you go from body to body. You have memory of a past life and how you died, and then you are born as a child and you have those memories again. So that's the obvious reasoning. Of course, we could interpret and think of other possible scenarios for this also, but this is the simplest one. So he's presented this to the scientific community. He's not saying one thing or the other. He's just presenting it and saying, this is the facts. Now, how do we explain this? But the conclusions look a little obvious. His disappointment in the whole thing is that the scientists ignore what he says, and they don't want to report, because they risk, if they say something in favor of it, they risk condemnation by the rest of the scientific community. So nobody wants to put their foot forward and say, this is a big, remarkable achievement, you know? And some skeptics, of course, try to, discredit his work or whatever, but not too successfully. So his work is there, but the scientists don't want to really touch it, even though they may be sympathetic to it. They want to touch it because of the bad name they will get, because it's not regular science. So he's a forerunner in this type of activity, investigation. So what he shows, actually, is that if you can remember previous experiences of somebody else, you can remember them, you have a recollection. Somehow, the obvious interpretation is that you were there in that previous body. If not, then at least some other person was there and they're coming into your body now. That's a rather more indirect way. So his conclusion is definitely we do reincarnate birth after birth based on that. So that is one field of investigation. Along with that, he's also investigated the fact that generally people that do have violent deaths carry the symptoms of that death into their new life in their body. And he gives vivid examples in his book. For instance, one boy was shot in the chest. He was a man in that last lifetime in a certain village some distance away from his present village. He was shot by a shotgun and he died because of the wound. It went right into his lungs or his heart. Got a hold there. There's an autopsy record. There's a report by the police of when he died, who killed him, whatever. All this is there in the police records. There's a sketch of his body, dead body with the bullet hole wounds in it even, which he shows a picture in his book. So in this lifetime, when he was born with some strange birthmarks on his body in exactly the same place as the bullet wounds. And he has a picture of that also. And the boy grew up and the parents didn't know what are these strange marks on his body, because they were obviously something very strange and not normal people have, a big hole with little holes around it, right on the middle of his chest. But as he grew up, then he began to recollect his previous lifetime, and he even recollected he was shot by a shotgun. In other words, what it shows is the trauma of death in your physical body somehow gets recorded in your mind, and then it looks as if the mind and the soul, they go to the next body, and they influence the physical body to pick up the same characteristics. So we get the influence there on the body. And you can't change that. It's a birthmark. And he gives many other examples, like that person that got wounded in their head. When they're born, they have a mark, big mark on their head. One person was shot in the head, got his ear blown off, half his ear blown off in last lifetime. This lifetime, he was born with half a ear. And one girl was killed by a train. Her leg was cut off. This lifetime, she was born without a leg. So he gives countless examples of this, of injuries or accidents or whatever. And people died, and the next lifetime, they come back with the same mark on their body in some form or other. So that shows how the experiences of one lifetime actually influence the next body even. So it's not the same body, but it's held, and the experience is held there, and it's so strong that it molds your next body. Yeah, that's the idea. So Krishna actually says it's in the Bhagavad Gita, what you think of when you die, you attain that. If you think of me, you go to Krishna. If you think of some person, you'll become like that. If you think of a dog, you become a dog. If you think of a deer, you become a deer. And so there's a case in the Bhagavatam, Srimad Bhagavatam, of one king. He renounced his kingdom. He practiced yoga, meditated on the Supreme Lord. He was very advanced. Then he became attached to a baby deer who was left by his mother. His mother died due to a tiger. And he was caring for the deer, and he became absorbed in the deer, and then he died. So he became a deer in his next lifetime. As a result of that. Yeah, and he has consciousness. He could remember as a deer that he was actually a king in the last lifetime who was doing austerities. Next lifetime, he became a human being again. But definitely, your thoughts are going to mold you. What you think of and what you're attached to, or what you fear, all these things influence you. In other words, the strong emotions, likes, dislikes, attachments, fears, repulsions, they're held in your mind or your mental body. And that mental body goes with you. And then it's going to influence your next body. This is how the Bhagavad Gita explains it. So therefore, when you die, you should think of something very wonderful. And then you get something wonderful. But the problem is, how are you going to think of something wonderful when you die? Because for most people, it's a fearful experience. Sometimes it's a painful experience. Definitely it's an uncomfortable experience. It's an unknown for many people. So because of the stress involved of that moment, many people will not remember. Their mind is going to go somewhere else automatically. So therefore, throughout one's life, one has to fix oneself on what one wants to attain in the next lifetime. If we don't do that and have a great attachment for that, when we die, we're going to forget. And we're going to think of something else. So usually when we do die, we can think of two things. That which we are most afraid of, or we hate the most, or that's which we like the most. Those two things. That's what we're most attached to. Huh? Because we have some affection for it. Maybe we're concerned about that. Bharat was attached to the deer because he thinks maybe the deer is going to die now. Yeah, I'm not here. So he had a great attachment to caring for the deer. Or, that's one thing. Or we may get some comfort from that person. They may be able to help us at that moment of death. So we're calling for them. As Ajamil, he called out for his son Narayana because he was affectionate to his son. You please help me, I'm dying. Somebody's running after me and you're going to grab me. So, you please help me. So, we may apply to someone out of great affection. Huh? The other is out of great repulsion or hatred or fear. We may think of somebody or something when we're dying. And then that's going to create another thing. Hmm? So, of course, Kamsa in the Bhagavatam, he was thinking of Krishna as an enemy all the time throughout his life up to his last moments. And so Krishna came and killed him. He died by Krishna's hand, actually. Huh? As a result of that, he did get some sort of benefit because he didn't remember the Supreme Lord. Because it was hatred, basically, his consciousness got annihilated. So, therefore, we have to be very careful what we think of when we're what we're attached to when we're alive. Huh? And basically, most people, and if they don't die in coma, which is also unfortunate because you're in a kind of a blank state, you don't think of anything. If you do think and you are conscious, one will think of the person one is most attached to. So one person who was Japanese, who was in the war, must be in the Korean War, I suppose. Couldn't have been the Second World War. He was too young for that. Anyway, he said he saw soldiers die in the war. So he said, you know, it is very strange that all these soldiers say the same thing when they die. And what do they say? They call out for their mother. They're the young soldiers, I suppose. So they're young boys, they're not married. And they have attachment for their family, particularly the mother. So when they're dying, they all call out for the mother, basically. All of them. Inevitable. All the soldiers are calling out for their mother when they die. Huh? So, in this way we see attachments themselves and those relationships are very strong. And even at the death moment, we may invoke those attachments when we're dying. So we'll be born in the next world with such attachments again. Oh, when they did the black box thing? What'd they say? Oh, really? Even the pilots? I see. I see. Okay. Yeah, so this is we see that one usually thinks of someone one is most attached to at the point of death. So this helps determine your next body. Now, of course, if you're attached to someone in this lifetime and you die, how is it, what are we going to get in our next lifetime? So, obviously we don't become that person or anything like that. But those relationships will generally continue. It is very difficult to understand how it happens, but generally over many lifetimes, people who have strong relationships keep bumping into each other birth after birth in different relationships. Sometimes mother and father, sometimes husband and wife, sometimes, you know, friend, whatever. But they seem to keep bumping into each other life after life. So there's records of that also. There's one record in some psychiatrist in England. He met all these different people who were having problems or strange experiences, at least, of strange recollections and strange dreams, very frightening dreams of burning and torture and things like that. And these people in this life didn't know each other to begin with, but they all came to the same doctor for some reason. And it turned out they all had similar experiences. And then the doctor traced all these experiences back to, I think, 12th century or 13th century. Albigensian was a group of Christians who were not Catholics. And at a certain point, the Catholic Church decided that they didn't want these people anymore. So they forced them all to become regular Catholics, or they tried to. So they had certain strongholds in Europe. One of them was in southern France, I think, and Bulgaria and others. They had like fortresses built up with castles and everything like that. So in this particular place, where apparently they all died, the army surrounded them and said, okay, now you have to become regular Catholics. And they said, no, we're not going to. So they said, okay, then you have to die. So they attacked the place, they got all the people, and they burned everybody. And burned them at the stake. So all these people had these used to have these recollections in this lifetime of, you know, fire and getting tortured and things like that. And some have scars on their back in this lifetime where they were hit by the people with the firebrands and things like that. So and they all came together in this lifetime. But it looks like in previous lifetimes, also many, many lifetimes, they somehow related with each other, the same group of people from the same, you know, religious community. They died together, and somehow they're coming back together in each lifetime over 500 years. Another case is a woman. And this is one psychiatrist in New York, I think, American psychiatrist. He had a case of one woman, without his intention of doing it, she regressed back 5,000 years and remembered 50 lifetimes or so, one after the other, up until the present day. And sometimes she was a man, sometimes she was a woman, sometimes she was high birth, sometimes low birth. Egypt was the first, Greeks, Rome, Middle Ages, Renaissance, up until the present time. So she had many, many experiences in there. But throughout these things, the people, different people she could recognize in this lifetime, she could recognize by looking in their eyes. She was in hypnotic regression, you know, and she would recount the lifetime. And then she would describe the people, and then she would look in their eyes, and she would recognize someone in this lifetime. So when she was in ancient Greece, she was a philosophy student, and she was describing how she would go to the teacher and they would learn philosophy, you know, like that. And she looked at the philosophy teacher, and then she looked very closely, and then she told the doctor, that's you. In this lifetime, the psychiatrist had been the philosophy professor 5,000 years ago. And in one lifetime, she was a sailor. A Portuguese sailor or a Dutch sailor, about 15th century or something like that. And the ship was attacked by pirates. And the pirates came on there, and she was a man, of course, in that lifetime, and one of the pirates came up to her and slit her throat. And as she was dying, she looked in the murderer's eyes, the one that was slitting her throat, and she saw, and then she recognized it was her girlfriend in this lifetime. So like that, she recognized her father in this lifetime was somebody else in the past lifetime. Yeah. So because of certain, not repulsion or attachment, these people tend to come back together. And if there's debt to pay, like the one that murdered this woman in her past lifetime, somehow came back in this lifetime because maybe guilt or something like that to pay back for that killing or whatever. So all sorts of relationships can carry over many births. So how does that take place? That takes place through the what we call the subtle body or the mental body. The mental body is very flexible, and it stores a lot of information and memories from many, many births, up to 5,000 years of information can be stored there in the subtle body. So it holds memories and impressions like that for long periods of time, and those influence our life. And they influence our physical body as well as our mentality in this lifetime. This body has, the mental body has a strange quality, not a strange quality, but a powerful quality that can make connections with other subtle bodies. And these connections are not broken at the point of death, because death is only a death of this body. Subtle body is the same subtle body. And that person's subtle body is also the same subtle body, birth after birth. So you make a connection. And once that connection is made, generally, if it is a strong, positive connection, then it is not destroyed. So life after life, somehow you have connection. That connection is not weakened by distance. So you could be born in one place, another person could be born in America, but the connection is there. So due to that connection, probably what happens is, sooner or later, the attraction takes place. You're not even conscious of it. And somehow you meet each other because of that. Because of that mental attraction. And you can find each other out because of that. Of course, it's even it's mysterious how animals sometimes can find their way home. over long distances. Our birds can navigate in the sky. It's very mysterious how they do that. But one possibility is their subtle body actually can connect with certain places and things, and they can find their way back to the subtle body. Maybe. That's my speculation. Because it's very difficult to explain how a bird can navigate using stars, because even human beings can't do that. Nobody knows. No, we look up in the sky and we're puzzled by the sky, most people, unless you're an astronomer. But how can the birds, they have less intelligence, recognize the patterns in the sky and navigate? That's the, you know, that's what science say. They look at the stars at night and they navigate themselves. It's a pretty far out explanation as far as I can see. So anyway, that is there. And even in plants, you know, plants of course are very primitive beings, and we would not expect to have much of a subtle body or mind at all, or they don't have a nervous system even for that matter. You have to do with sensitivity somehow or other. And one scientist in America, he was an experimenter, so he had some little gadgets hooked up to his plant to record their sensitivity and how the metabolism, you know, little waves coming out of the plant, and any reaction in the plant was recorded there. He was going to do another experiment with shrimps, live shrimps, but he had to kill them first to do the experiment. So he took the shrimps and put them in boiling water to kill them. When he did that, then he looked at the plants, and the plants were, the graph was going wild, you know, and it was completely abnormal, you know. In other words, the plants seemed to have reacted to the killing of the shrimps. And he thought, how can they do that? They don't have any senses. Then he thought, well, let's try the experiment again. And this time he did the experiment where he put the shrimps in another place where they couldn't even be seen, in another room. And then he killed them. And then the plant reacted again, even over distance. So that shows that even plants can detect, you know, other living entities and their condition of life or whatever over great distances. It's for some mechanism or other. We don't know what it is. And Russians also did an experiment with cats. This is not a very nice experiment, but anyway. So they hooked up the mother cat, you know, with the little instruments, its heartbeat, all this brain waves, etc. You see her sensitivity. Now, she had kittens. They took the kittens and they put them on a submarine somewhere out in the middle of the Arctic Ocean someplace underneath, you know, 1,000 miles away. Then they killed the kittens. And when they killed the kittens, then the mother reacted over a distance of, you know, 1,000 miles. Exactly when the kittens were killed, the mother got disturbing, you know, sensations in her body. So somehow there's a connection. In other words, there's a connection, and she could understand what was happening to her kittens over a great distance, even though she's an animal. So we see that phenomenon even in human beings. Sometimes mothers, they understand that their child is in danger, and then they run to see the child is, you know, going over the ledge of the building, or, you know, playing in front of the car or something like that. So we may think it's only coincidence, but actually it's because that connection is there, and not conscious of it, somehow or other they know that this is happening, and they can perceive it on a subtle level, even if not consciously, and then they react. So in other words, the subtle body is very flexible and can extend itself in different ways for perceptions in other places, can extend itself and establish connections with other people, with attachments, and these can last for many, many lifetimes. So the mind is very powerful in terms of attraction, repulsion, connections, memories, etc. And therefore, it determines our future. So Bhagavad Gita tells us we have to be very careful what goes on in the mind. We have to control the mind, basically. That doesn't mean we simply sit there and, you know, stop the mind from acting. We cannot do that. But rather, we have to have a goal in life, what we want to achieve in life. And that has to be cultivated in the mind. Because what goes on in the mind will happen in the physical body, or if not in this lifetime, in the next lifetime. So therefore, we have to be very careful what we cultivate in our mind. Because this is going to determine our future now and in the next lifetime. So that it'll carry over. Usually we think of next lifetime, a reincarnation, okay, next body. But it's obvious that the effects will happen in this lifetime also. What you think of produces results in this lifetime, not only next lifetime. It may produce immediate results or long-term results over many years. Nevertheless, the results will come. So that's why it's very essential that we don't wait for later. Right now, we have to determine what we want as our goal in life and fix that in the mind. And then we can achieve that in life. And if we don't do that, it's too late later on because we'll miss that opportunity because time passes. Huh? So, Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says we have to begin controlling the mind. The mind is the source of our destination. It can elevate us upwards or it can push us downwards. We can degrade ourselves to a hellish existence or we can elevate ourselves to a heavenly existence. But this essential element is the mind. Based on this, of course, Krishna gives many instructions of what we should do and not do, etc. Now, when we reincarnate like this, of course, then what happens is that we go from body to body. Now, we'll try to get better and better bodies. That's the obvious thing. and less suffering in the bodies, yeah? But how does one do that? So there's a mechanism for this. It's called karma. And not only we have our memories and impressions carried over, in the case of like the young girl with her leg cut off and whatever, those impressions carry over, but also that there's a law of reaction for each of our activities. And if the activity creates unnecessary violence in the world, we get similar violence upon ourselves. In other words, whatever pain we inflict upon others in the material world is reflected back on ourselves in the future. We will get suffering. For the suffering we cause others, in that proportion, we get suffering on ourselves. If we do good to other people, we get that back on our life also in terms of goodness, our happiness in our next lifetime. So in Vedic life, we call this papa and punya. Papa means sin, punya means piety. Pious acts and sinful acts. So sinful acts are those acts which are unnecessarily violent and they cause disturbance for other living entities. Therefore, we will get suffering in our future because of that. And punya means piety. That means we do acts of charitable work. We help others, other living entities. As a result of that, without doing anything in the next lifetime, we get good conditions of living. So this is the law of karma, and it is unavoidable. It's a moral law, and of course, scientifically, it's very difficult to understand how that would work. But it is put in the material world because there's a moral controller behind it. That is, God is behind the whole material world. And he's put that law there, especially for the human beings. And we cannot escape that law. So every act you do has repercussions in terms of papa and punya, sin and piety, in terms of good or bad. You get the reactions on yourself in the future in terms of suffering and enjoyment. So, of course, nobody likes to suffer. But the problem is that generally we also like to enjoy. So a lot of our enjoyment will be linked up with violence or disturbance to other living entities. Now this is the big problem because we want the enjoyment but we have to cause suffering to others. So we want the enjoyment, we also get the suffering. We get a mixed scenario. And this is a continuous cycle. And if we're caught up in that, it's very difficult to escape because we want more and more enjoyment and we get more and more suffering. So it's a very frustrating experience. How do we get out of that? Through those experiences themselves, which are just, if you cause violence, you get the violence. This is a just law, just like in the government. If that happens enough, then we have a little bit of realization as a human intelligence that it is not so good to cause violence because we'll get it on ourselves again. So better we refrain from all this and minimize our sinful activities or our violence. Yes, we want our enjoyment, but we'll get it in such a way we minimize the violence in the world. So when a person starts doing that, actually they're, let's say, progressing spiritually. And they're going upwards. And, of course, conversely, they'll realize that by doing good activities, charitable activities, selfless activities, they also get a very peaceful existence. So ultimately, as far as living in the material world goes, the more one refrains from sin and the more piety one does, then the more peaceful we be in the material world. We don't have to struggle so much and we don't get disturbance. So that's, you can say, the ideal in the material world. However, the problem with that is that it doesn't prevent you from going from body to body to body yet. And you still have to keep getting bodies. And this can go on forever. Now, that situation, we say, oh, it's nice, okay, we're in a comfortable situation, if you're a willed body, but it's not such a problem. But there's always a risk there. Because we see that in spite of the fact that we want to do everything nice, always there's some temptation, and we may do the simple activity and get violent, then we have to get the suffering. So nothing is certain for us in the material world. We can go up and down all the time, life after life. There's always a danger that we're going to do the wrong activity, and then we have to suffer. So we cannot guarantee 100% peaceful life ever in the material world, no matter who we are. The second problem is that actually this is working in the getting comfort in the material world, but actually behind the mind and the body there is a soul, and the soul actually does not belong with material energy alone at all, because it's completely different and it cannot really relate with matter because it is opposite. The soul is conscious, the matter is unconscious. The soul is eternal, matter is continually changing. So there's incompatibility between matter and soul. But due to illusion in the material world with our subtle body and our gross body, we're thinking I am a body and I can enjoy matter. So we get an illusion of happiness. But an illusion of happiness is not real happiness, obviously. And so therefore the soul is left unsatisfied in any case, even in the sattvic, in the situation where we're peaceful and we have a sattvic life, we don't commit violence, material body, still the satisfaction is going to be there, spiritually speaking. Because we're still relating in the material world. But that state of peacefulness in the material world is a stepping stone for spiritual life. Because in that state, our perception, our intelligence, intuition is not covered over. And therefore we begin to perceive the nature of spirit as opposed to matter. So that's the beginning of spiritual life. So we, in other words, we reincarnate birth after birth. We get karmas, and the karmas teach us to refrain from violence and act without selfishness and do more compassionate activities. Through that we rise up to a peaceful existence where we can perceive our spiritual nature. So this begins spiritual life at that point. Then we understand we're a spirit soul, not a body. And if we do that, we have a full understanding of our spiritual nature, then we don't have to come back to the material world. So if we have our spiritual nature fully understood, then we go to the spiritual world, not the material world. So that is the ultimate goal of the soul. After many, many lifetimes, going through all species of life to the human species, and sitting in the human species for so long, finally, the goal is to get out of this material world completely and break that existence of duality where we're a soul and there's a material world which is completely different and trying to enjoy there. In the spiritual world, everything is spiritual. Everything is eternal. Everything is conscious. So there's no contradiction. So that's the actual place for the soul in the spiritual world. So this is a, generally it's a long existence in the material world, birth after birth. And if you want, you can continue forever, reincarnating. But if you desire, as a human being, you desire to get out, then it becomes possible to get out. And the opportunity is always there. There's an arrangement by which we can actually stop our material existence and end up in the spiritual world. There are spiritual practices for doing this. Now we're talking about reincarnation, but the whole purpose is to get out of reincarnation, actually. First of all, reincarnate ourselves upwards so that we're at least on a higher level of consciousness. And then from that consciousness, get ourselves out of reincarnation completely. That is the final idea. Reincarnation means that it's the body in the material world. And there's a soul attached to the body. And you keep on getting bodies. The soul keeps getting bodies. So that's not a natural condition. So the whole idea is to get out of that condition of reincarnating. We detach yourself from the body and go to the spiritual world. So the, any genuine spiritual process should have a method of doing that, of stopping reincarnation and getting to the spiritual world instead of the material world. So there are many processes for doing that. Some are based on negation. Let us cut off the relationship with the material body and with the mind and everything and say it's all useless and reject everything. That system is possible, but it's very difficult for us. and one has to be highly qualified with determination and austerity and patience. It's a long process of controlling the mind and then rejecting the activities, etc. The other process is the positive process, and that is the process of attraction, positive attraction. This easier process. The soul is, I say, conscious, eternal, capacity for knowledge, capacity for action, capacity for experience and bliss. It's the nature of the soul. So to repress everything is very difficult for us. So better to express somehow. But the problem is, in the material world, we're expressing action, feelings, etc., which ultimately are nature of the soul also. But the problem is we're doing it in the wrong way. That's why we're in the material world. So the problem in the material world is we're expressing all these things, but basically with a selfish intention. That I want to get this for myself. Then we'll consider everyone else afterwards. First I must get for myself. So that's why we get the violence in the material world. We get our enjoyment at the expense of somebody else. So this is the unfortunate position of the material world, material consciousness. So how can we get around that? We need enjoyment, we need experience, we need knowledge, etc. The only other way we can do that is to get that as a secondary result. In other words, get our happiness as a secondary result without being selfish. So if we direct ourselves towards someone without personal motivation, that means we do it with devotion and love. So if we direct ourselves to another person and do activities for that person with very pure intentions of love, this is the process by which we can get out of the material world. In other words, we encourage the soul to develop unconditional love for the Supreme Lord. That's all. And in that process, we break through karma and all the impressions of previous lifetimes and this attachment to material body and the subtle body. And we end our reincarnation in this material world as a result of that. So this process we call Bhakti Yoga. That's the name of the club, yeah? Bhakti Yoga Club. So this is the process, devotional yoga. Yoga means to join together. So we're joining together. We're directing ourselves towards the Supreme Lord with bhakti or devotion. So you don't have so much devotion in the beginning. We have a little inclination. That has to be cultivated. So the process of doing that is bhakti yoga. And that is we do a practice in order to increase that attachment to the Lord. And not only attachment to the Lord, but attachment with unconditional surrender and love and without any personal motivation. When that's perfect, then we're no longer in the material world. We don't have to reincarnate anymore. Okay. Any question? It's not considered very fortunate generally, because you're not thinking of anything when you're in a coma. Now, the case, I don't know how true this is, but there was one person, he does astral travel and all sorts of things like that. So he observed people when they die, different conditions and where you go when you die, different people, you know. So some people ended up in a very strange state after they died. They didn't go anywhere. They were just lying down in a subtle state in their subtle body, sleeping in a bed, a subtle bed, I guess. And they were just sleeping. You couldn't wake them up. And they slept like that. Yeah. So people that are thinking, okay, it's better just to blank everything out. And then you end up in a blank state after you die, like a sleep state. Those people that don't like life at all, and they're suicide cases, that's a little bit worse for them in one sense. Because they're actually giving up their responsibility as a human being at that point. I don't want to live anymore. And they do have a certain lifespan to live and experience certain karmas. They're trying to avoid that and give up the responsibility. So they get stuck. And they don't have a material body, so to speak. They got a subtle body without a gross body. And they're stuck in that. No, they can get out of that also. Usually they get out after the lifespan is finished. And they were to die, you know, 20 years later, then they'll stay in a ghost body. I'll say ghost body for 20 years, and then they'll go out. Yeah. So, okay, anyway, back to the coma state. Because they die in such a condition, generally, it is possible when they're just in a comatose state in the next lifetime. They don't even reincarnate because they're in this, you know, subtle state where they don't have any desires almost, you know. So it's not a very good state also. It's like a sleep state almost. Huh? Of course, the other idea is that not only your death state, but also what you do during your life, you get credit for that. Yeah? So if one does, let's say, devotional activities in his lifetime, but he dies in a coma, it doesn't mean he's finished. Because he still has the credit of his previous activities, so that will be taken into account also. So generally, one who does devotional activities, spiritual activities in a lifetime, he gets credit for that. He'll take another birth as a human being, and he'll continue his activities in spite of the fact that he died in coma or whatever. So it's not an absolute rule that you end up in a very bad state with a coma. Depends on your activities of lifetime also. The people that are like in this state where they're, you know, like kind of lingering between life and death, that is so. Another point is that sometimes the people, it's not time to die, but they want to die anyway. So they're, okay, it's finished, and they're half out of the body, and they're in a kind of a lingering state, but according to karma, they have to live a little longer. Huh? So they want to get out, and they're half out already. So their body's almost dead, but at the same time, you know, the karma is still keeping them in there until the, you know, it's up, and then the soul leaves like that. So it's another condition. Yeah, if one is very attached to one's condition of life in this lifetime, you may become a ghost for that reason, even if you die at the proper time. Anyone saw that movie Sixth Sense? I didn't see it, actually. How is it that people don't recognize me anymore? Why are they ignoring me all the time? They won't speak to me, they won't look at me or anything. And they, like in a dream, you're thinking, okay, I'm having all these experiences. It's obviously a different body from this. But you think it's you. So when they die, they think, this is me. And they got a subtle body, and they're in this real world and everything. And they're doing things. But there's no effect with other people. They can't communicate. So it's a rather funny experience for them. So many people are in that state. They don't even realize they're dead. And they still think, this is me. I've got my body. I'm doing all these activities. And other people become very frustrated with that type of experience. They're a ghostly body. And they're attached to the place. Nothing happens. So then they begin to cause problems for other people also. So those are the bad ghosts. You know, they throw things around the room or whatever and do things like that.
See,
the idea with the death thing is that one is contaminated by death, so therefore one should not, you know, go to the temple or do all these activities, whatever. That's the, we call the smarta convention. Because you're impure. And the rites are done by certain priests, and they try to purify the person, get rid of his karmas or whatever, through the shraddha ceremonies. And the family members, generally, they don't do anything for 12 days, 13 days, or 15 days, or 1 month, whatever, according to their caste. That's the general thing. But definitely, if we do devotional activities, it's beneficial in any case for anybody. So that overrides the impurity injunction, actually. Though smartest won't accept that. They won't accept that, but because they're ritual, you know, stuck to the rituals. But basically, any devotional activities is much stronger than any other activity to help that person and purify the atmosphere or whatever. It's much stronger. Anything spiritual is much stronger than the rituals they do for, you know, karma rituals. What do young people? Young people, they're, in other words, the intellect is not so much developed. Generally, the condition when they go to school, you know, and you become very externalized in your consciousness and your logical abilities are stressed so much. And let's say that part of the body is really gets really developed. That tends to suppress these other, we can say, the right brain or the left brain? One or the other. Anyway, one gets suppressed in the process. The emotional side and the intuitive side gets suppressed. Yeah? So in other words, that's the part that also can bring about recollections of previous lifetimes. So when people are children, generally they're not so developed. So therefore, it's more likely that these experiences can come out into their consciousness easier. But as they develop further and further, their intellect gets more developed, then generally that gets suppressed. It gets hidden away.
This is an understanding of karma, the laws of karma. Is it better understood as one's consciousness becomes more purified?
Do we understand? Oh, definitely. Yeah. In other words, in tamoguna you don't understand anything, therefore you do more and more worse and worse activities. It's a hopeless state. You simply make it worse. Because you try to enjoy more and you do more violent activities, so it becomes worse and worse. It's a destructive chain. In the mode of passion, one's more intelligent, of course, and one may restrain oneself ultimately, but in order to get more enjoyment also. So in the mode of goodness, basically, then we can begin to understand how karma works very nicely. We're a little more sensitive to not only ourselves, to other people and to other living entities, to the world, and how things are all acting as a whole, holistically. Everything is related to everything else. So that's a sattvic vision of the world.
For example, Aboriginal culture, there are many aspects of another, they've been indigenous and everything. I'm not going to say it's the first thing, but in many aspects, they show symptoms of
goodness. Oh, yeah. In spite of eating meat. Well, I would think that this is, you know, it's a matter of environment. That in certain places, there's nothing else to eat. Like Eskimos also, there's nothing else to eat except, you know, the whales and the walruses or the polar bears or whatever they eat up there. And the fish. In the wintertime especially, there's no vegetables growing at all. And so in the desert areas also, maybe that's the only thing available. So what can they do? Basically, you know, it's a matter of necessity. So
there could be acting on actual knowledge.
Yeah. To some extent, yeah. Okay. Very additional.